hall.
It's the computer side that breaks the box.
We're going to open the committee on agriculture and natural resources. I want to welcome everybody that's here today on April 17th. We have a number of bills, though. I will tell you that we did not receive our amendments for House Bill 3337 or for 3436. We've taken one of those already off. So both of those are going to be moved because of that.
And which one?
3436 and 3337, last two of them.
3436.
It had already been taken off on your
On
the revised
so
one,
no
it had already
sessions.
Been taken off.
Okay. So no work sessions.
So there's no...
Possible work sessions.
Right. Those are two bills we'd heard before. We expected the amendments to be back. They didn't make it. So.
Got it.
The 3337 was off.
Yeah. Those off the list.
So if you have the revised one, it's just 3337. Okay. With that, we're going to open three hearings at the same time because they all really talk about similar subjects. So we're going to open a public hearing on 3495, public hearing on 3479, and a public hearing on 3523. And we have a number of legislators here. So, and you can speak to each or every one of them if you'd like. And we'll have Representative Krieger, Representative Boone, come on up to the... And as you're sitting there, we'll have our administrator say a little bit about each one of the bills.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill, so we'll go in order here, 3495 excludes natural resource property from the value of gross estate for the purposes of the Oregon Inheritance Tax. The bill defines natural resource property and limits the amount of the exclusion to $10 million. House Bill 3479 excludes natural resource property and property used in commercial fishing operations from the value of a gross estate for the purposes of the inheritance tax. Also defines natural resource property, limits the amount of the exclusion, and specifies that the exclusion applies only if the property is transferred to a spouse, child, grandchild, or brother or sister of the deceased. And then finally, House Bill 3523 excludes farm use real property and equipment from the value of the gross estate subject to an inheritance tax and defines farm use property. All three bills have a subsequent referral to the Revenue Committee.
And I also, Representative Clem, did you want to join them or do you want to do it from up here?
Makes no difference.
There. I'll put you there as well. And with that, whoever wants to go first.
Well, since age before beauty, I guess.
I'm confused, Debbie.
Just a pup.
That's because Representative Krieger is just a young whippersnapper.
That's right.
Yeah. That's it. And for the record, my name is Deborah Boone, and I represent the Upper Left Coast, House District 32. And I appreciate you hearing this bill today. I'm actually going to be testifying just on House Bill 3479. And I appreciate you accommodating our schedule. I'm chairing emergency prep at the same time. So this bill will save our natural resource-based businesses in the long run, and I think it'll be a win-win for Oregon's families who make their living from farming, ranching, timber, and commercial fishing, and orcharding. But I think that falls under farming. When a family member inherits a natural resource-based land venture or commercial fishing business, they often face paying enormous taxes and are forced to cut the trees that they ordinarily wouldn't cut, or to sell off the land they prefer to keep in the business, in their family business. And when they sell the land, they usually sell it to a larger corporation, which then the biggest loser becomes the state because corporations don't pay the taxes and the business is no longer operating, paying its normal income tax and property taxes. The commercial fishing vessel can't really be chopped off partially to pay taxes, so they're forced to sell the whole piece. And these businesses are a little different because they have the majority of their wealth wrapped up in their property and equipment that is used to operate their businesses. You are going to hear some of their testimony that more finely tunes this a little bit more than I am, and I don't want to be repetitive or steal their thunder. But I think this is a good bill for the citizens of our rural areas engaged in their family businesses and for our state. And we've even talked to a lot of the environmental community, and they like it because it actually keeps trees on the ground, or in the ground, roots in the ground. boots on the ground, boots in the ground, whatever. And it keeps, then I can speak from a little bit of personal experience. We have a tree farm, and we just added some acreage to it from our neighbor's tree farm. And now we have 6 species of trees on the ground or in the ground. And really, that's, if that happened to us, that's what we would be faced with doing. My next-door neighbor had 400 acres in prime Douglas fir, and they were very, very carefully thinning and using small loads of big trees, put it that way, to maximize their dollars without decimating their forest. They had planned to pass on to their family. When they did, the family had to cut 90% of the land, of the trees on the land, in order to pay the taxes, inheritance taxes, and then you just end up having, and they really did have to pretty much clear cut it. It was in, I think, the 60s, late 60s. There was no Forest Practices Act at that time. So now they have replanted it, but they're 40 years away from the next rotation. And the family members who would have been operating that business are no longer in that business, and they're doing other things. They actually, 2 of them work for ODFNW. So I think that this is a win-win for our state, for our families in the rural areas, and helps keep the family business going, and I know there will be some other issues I won't repeat. So thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Roman, committee members. For the record, I'm Wayne Krieger, State Representative for District 1. I refer to this legislation as the Family Forest and Farm Preservation Act. And the concept when we came up with it was Representative Boone and Representative Clem and others that we talked to. Representative Schaffer was in favor of it and was going to help. I would just say that if you look in Oregon, there's been a steady loss of private forest lands, family forest lands, and also agricultural land. In the case of forest lands, they have been sold and trees cut off often just to pay for the taxes, as Representative Boone had testified. I want to be a little more specific about what we come up against in the forestry issue compared to the ag or even commercial fish. A death tax obligation for a forest landowner of $100,000 doesn't mean that you're going to pay $100,000. You're going to pay the death tax of $100,000. You're going to pay the state income tax on that and everything else that you cut, the federal tax, the severance tax, the forest tax, the property tax, and the reforestation costs of those lands, the management and stand maintenance costs for those lands. And if you work your, do the work yourself, as I do, you can work yourself to death so that the process can start with the next generation. To get the $100,000, you may have to cut $300 worth of timber to get there. That's not in the best interest environmentally if we want to preserve those lands and have those people cut those trees when the market isn't down so they don't lose value. House Bill 3470 make it possible for family-owned natural resource lands to be passed generation to generation and promote stewardship and conservation of these lands. It would provide an opportunity for young people to stay, live, and raise their families on farms and forest lands here in Oregon. Our commercial fish families often have large value in their boats, gear, ice storage type of facilities, and they may have associated business such as fish markets or small restaurants. Again, House Bill 3470 allowed them to pass these assets to their family members. Large corporations who have similar assets don't pay inheritance tax. Why make farmers, ranchers, forest landowners, and commercial fishermen pay a death tax? They have, in fact, already paid a tax on these values over the 50 years or more that they might own those lands. I'm going to leave it there. There's a couple of amendments that are part of the bill, and Representative Clem can address one of those.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Brian Clem, State Representative from here in Central and East Salem, and I just wanted to make just a couple brief comments about the collection of bills, because we're open on all 3 of them, I believe. There's actually pieces to like about each of them, and so I would sort of look at maybe combining them over in revenue or on the way to revenue at some point. We've got really in the bill that I had originally been thinking of a section that I think is preferable on equipment because often the equipment is one of the biggest expenses that someone's got, you know, tons of money into tractors and combines or forestry harvesting equipment. And again, you can't just sell a wheel and pay the taxes and still be able to keep doing forestry or farming. And the whole principle, as my colleagues have indicated, is we want people to continue doing the activities that they're doing and not have an issue related to needing to sell something off to pay the taxes. And often, you know, what you'll sometimes hear on like a talk radio show or something is, well, I've never heard of one farmer who had to, you know, lost the farm to pay taxes. And I've had to work to combat that with a lot of my colleagues in my party because there are situations where people have sold off acreage or sold off things. And I had one that came in an extended part of my family where I've just got this great uncle, Hubert, and he just refused to go through any kind of estate tax planning. He just did not believe in paying a lawyer for any of this. So when he died, his kids had the tax bill, and they didn't know exactly what to do to come up with the $225,000 worth of just timberland. And he lived like on a mobile home near Crawfordsville, where my folks were from. And they sold it to a timber company and clear cut it. And, you know, I'm not sure exactly why they sold it instead of just cutting it themselves, or maybe some reason. But for whatever reason, they did. They sold the land to pay the taxes. And, you know, that's one story. And that's just somebody in my part of the family. Now, what I found when I married into my wife's family is they already had it set up, but I don't know how much they spent in lawyers over the years getting it done where shares, they put the acreage into an S corporation, and then those shares were gifted over the years. So some farmers have spent tens of thousands of dollars trying to do something that we could do here today. Or at least get the process going on it. And I don't think that we need to continue to have a state policy that says if you have the best lawyers and CPAs, you're going to figure out how to get around some of this. But if you don't, and you're just trying to work your land and that's it, and you don't have lawyers, then you're not going to be able to, because that's really the practical effect of why farmers haven't had to sell the farm, is because they spent a ton of money on good lawyers. Addition of forestry and fishing, which is in 3479, which I'm also a chief co-sponsor of, was an enhancement. I intended it to mean sort of natural resource property. I hadn't thought about the fishing boats, and Representative Boone alerted me to that, and that makes a lot of sense. But I ended up in the other bill talking about farming, and it really should have been natural resource property, which I think the committee bill uses that phrase. So you can mix and match and do a good bill. I myself don't favor an overall you know, repeal the estate tax or exemption. I think it needs to be specific because of the way the taxation works on stocks and other things, that sometimes the capital gain that's built in would never be paid if you didn't have an estate tax, because their asset gets revalued the day they die at a brand new basis. So that's a large tax break to people. This is a idea that says that we want to promote this activity for the next generation. To that effect, or to that end, you've got -2 amendments, which say that you don't qualify for this exemption in 3479 if you don't work the land for 5 of the next 8 years. So if you inherit farm or timber or boat from your parent, and you immediately turn around and sell it and get out of farming, forestry, or fishing, you don't get this exemption. It's a way to promote continuing the activity, which was important for many of the people I talked to about the bill. Not everybody, I realize. And with that, you got a much more esteemed colleague here than me.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Betsy Johnson. I'm the state senator from District 16. The benefit of being last to testify is that everything has been said, just not by everybody. And so I am going to associate myself with the opinions of my colleagues who have testified before me and come in support of House Bill 3479 specifically. It's recently come to my attention a situation where forest land was passed by inheritance, and the only way that the death taxes could be satisfied is to cut the timber. The timber is priceless to the family as standing timber for its aesthetic, its natural beauty, its contribution to the environment and to habitat. But the land will by necessity be logged to pay the taxes. It seems to me to run counter to the environmental ethic that we're trying to maintain in this state to have that occur. House Bill 3479 will move in the direction of addressing this problem by keeping tracts of forest and farmland intact as they pass intergenerationally. It seems to me ironic that as I scurried down here, and I apologize for keeping the committee waiting, but as I scurried down here, there were people lining up in the hall all ready to testify and to appear before the Land Use Fairness Committee tonight. And in no colleagues, you're welcome. I just wanted to let you know
there are three of us on this committee who are going to be there.
Four of us.
Four of us.
Four of us.
But it seems to me somewhat ironic that we should be hearing a bill that in no small measure might bring relief to some of those landowners who are now seeking to divide farms and forest land to find economic benefit in it. If there was some way that we could encourage the kind of stewardship ethic that keeps those tracts of land intact, I think we move a great deal forward in preserving family farms and small woodlots for all of the attributes that I've already articulated in my testimony. So I hope that you would give House Bill 3479 and the -1 amendments your thoughtful consideration and move them forward.
Thank you very much. Any questions for this?
No. Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I do. In 3495, and you may not have that in front of you, which was the from the Committee on the Judiciary, they come up with an amount, or they use an amount, or state an amount of $10 million. In your bill, you use a figure of $7.5 million. And in 3523, it doesn't state a figure. And so, since you are the sponsors of this bill, would it...
Take my name off.
Is there a figure that is most appropriate?
I am asking
you because clearly all these bills are related.
Hey, Representative Chair Roland and Representative Maurer, when we sat down, Representative and I, Boone, and talked about what was reasonable and what would be, because we talked about a small woodland owner as defined in law as 5,000 acres or less, but there's no such definition for agricultural land. And even though there's a difference in potential growth on east side, west side, it's much more diverse as far as east side, west side, as far as cattle, farming, ranching, as far as the value of the land. So we took the 5,000 acres out of the ag side. But what we also felt was, and it had been talked about, that some people have invested a huge amount of money in setting up family trusts and stuff. I just went through it again just to update. Mine was over $1,000. I'm not certain it's right yet. We continue to invest in it. And I was looking at the time that probably if you were a valued ownership of over that $7.5 million, you probably would have the means of cash flow off of those types of properties that had that type of value to warrant maybe a level of having an accountant and an attorney setting you up a trust where you can move stock and do those things. But a lot of the smaller ones, the land doesn't produce enough really to continue that type of operation. So that was part of the reason I went to $7.5 million. There were talks of from some of the people that I visited with that would have liked to have seen it higher. But I felt that exemption would be enough that in most cases of the small farm forest landowners, they would be able to handle the tax over that amount and be viable and keep it within the family.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Other comments from this?
I have only really been working on 3479.
I can answer mine. Yeah, I actually don't think there should be a limit. My bill's the one that has no limit. I just think you should be exempt. And my premise, and this comes right out of the federal tax code, by the way, on the five of the next 8 years. That's part of the federal law. That's how you qualify for additional estate tax relief federally, is having a closely held business that you continue to operate. I think that's the more important test, and I don't think you should pay any taxes unless you basically sell it and get out of the business, and then I think you should pay at that point.
And then a follow-up, was there a discussion about maybe not a level of $7.5 million, but just other closely held businesses? And I'm hearing the testimony, it's clear to me about the importance, the environmental importance of these tracts of lands, which I understand, but also the closely held businesses
maybe not at that level, but at some level, to be part of this bill, because it's about, it ends up being about family in the way this is for, at least that's how I see it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Maurer, while I philosophically agree with the direction that you're headed in the context of House Bill 3479, that discussion did not occur. This bill was designed for the really the preservation of family forest and family agriculture and then the fishing. But philosophically, I think that you raise a very valid point.
Well, I guess I could throw my hat in on 3479. That was exactly it because of the fact that it's really hard to come up with the cash. Sometimes these businesses don't gain a lot of revenue from them, but they have a lot of money tied up in property and equipment. And so you're basically, and the main piece is the property and the fishing boat that goes with equipment. You know, if you can sell all your nets and pots and then you've just got a bare boat, what do you do then? You can't really fish. You still have to gear up. In timber and farming, you have equipment to help you operate, but probably the bulk of your value is in the land itself. So,
any other questions? Oh, Representative?
Chair, just for the record, I like the good chair of Judiciary's draft bill that says $10 million. I think that's a good round number. And if you recall, I am the one that, it's yes, from your committee.
Committee and Judiciary,
it's
the first
it's
bill.
It's the interim committee.
Senior Representative McPherson.
I defer to the prior chair of Judiciary.
It doesn't his say, handiwork. It doesn't there say interim. It does not say interim.
It doesn't
interim.
Say it.
It
doesn't say interim. But, Mr. Chair, I carried, you know, I coordinated all of the estate tax last time and carried it on the floor to some yes votes and some no votes in this room. But the only thing I would encourage is that whatever we do, we consolidate it and do it here and send one over to revenue at this point. I'm experienced enough in revenue after 2 years in a row. If we send three, that's going to be problematic. But we pick a course of action. We pick the course, send it over with some sort of close to unanimous decision so that we would have more opportunity in revenue to get it
through.
Chair Robin, I think if you look in 3479, the definition at the top talks about equipment or property. And if you look up that definition of property, it includes equipment of real property. Also, Representative Clem's dash twos and dash ones would both be needed. The dash one increased a little bit the definition of who would qualify as expanded definition of family. And, of course, the dash two is 5 to 8 years. And then, as I said before, deleting the land 5,000-acre designation for agriculture because it varies so much in value.
Mr. Representative
Clem. You know, I thought of another one today and made a few phone calls. Just want to get your input on it. And it might be something that actually Farm Bureau or OAN could talk about. But in a family-held S-Corp, which is what most people set up when they're trying to do estate tax, you own shares. You don't own property or equipment. You own shares. And I'm not sure that we have specified that in an S-Corp, shares of an S-Corp that owns, you know, property and equipment would be covered. So most people who've done the right thing, you know, and had the money to do lawyers, they wouldn't get any relief from this bill, I don't think. And so we might need an additional bit of work maybe on that part to add in S-Corp or family-held, you know, business shares.
Mr. Chair, if I could respond, and Representative Clem, I guess my only admonition is that we don't need to hit a home run at every at-bat, and if we can make some incremental progress on an issue that is vexing, and again, I go back to the farm and forest tract owners, if we can make some incremental progress and prove the world doesn't end, we could come back and take another go at it later. I would rather send a bill that has a chance of passage than to try to catch everything in one vehicle and risk losing it.
Thank you for that. It's actually one of the reasons why I think that sometimes sending three have an advantage than sending one because. But I'll go
I've
with you on
this revenue, moment. Mr. Chair. At this point in stage, it's better to have a committee coming out unanimously to them saying this is what we think is best, and I totally agree with the good senator that if we have something everybody agrees through and put it out, it's a 75% solution that we get across both chambers and signed, I'm more happy with. I've played poker on the other side already. Yeah. And lost.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions for this group? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I appreciate your forbearance in getting me down here.
Yeah, no problem.
See you in an hour.
So we have, is this the right one?
This is the first one. Oh, we did get
it. Are we all the same people? Yep. Oh, okay. It looks like, well, I guess we'll bring them up in groups of two. Don Schellenberg from Farm Bureau and Jeff Stone. And you can talk about all three of them since they're all open. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Don Schellenberg over in Farm Bureau. Appreciate the opportunity to talk about all three at one time.
Yeah.
Don Schellenberg representing Oregon Farm Bureau. Farm Bureau, you know, supports the principle of all three of these bills, obviously. Eliminating the inheritance tax has long been a goal of Oregon farmers and ranchers. There is no social valid reason for government to require the heirs of a decedent to hand over a portion of the value of the estate simply because the owner died. The inheritance tax is simply an ancient practice that has no useful or practical purpose other than raising revenue for state government. It has outlived its usefulness and should itself be buried. These three bills propose bringing this unseemly practice to a halt for some or all farmers and ranchers. It's our position that any tax levied by the state should be based on the individual's ability to pay. While we do not advocate for a sales tax, the ability to pay can either be calculated by the amount of money spent from net income or by the amount of net income itself. An inheritance tax meets neither of these criteria. The increased value of farm or ranch during the owner's lifetime is primarily due to inflation. Even if there were no inflation and the owner succeeds in gaining wealth through good management decisions, the rationale for taxing the increase is non-existent. The exemption threshold in these three bills varies, as you've already mentioned, from 7.5 in HB 3479 to 100% in House Bill 3523. Simply because of inflation, it's not difficult for the average full-time farmer or rancher to have $1 million just in equipment and other personal property. Two tractors and two combines can get you there in a big hurry, and that doesn't even count the land. The problem with the inheritance tax and agriculture is that there's no liquid assets to pay the tax when the owner dies. Paying the tax necessitates either borrowing a large sum to pay the tax or selling a portion of the income producing assets. Either option can make a farm or ranch operation unprofitable and in some cases unnecessarily require the sale of the entire operation. House Bill 3523 most closely fits the policy on this issue adopted by the Oregon Farm Bureau House of Delegates. Our policy calls for the abolishment of Oregon's inheritance tax. If necessary, we would, you know, accept something less, maybe in descending order, 3495 with a $10 million threshold and 3479 with a $7.5 million exemption threshold. In the case of either the last two bills or in the case of any bill, I guess I would say, based on the discussion that you had when it goes over to the Revenue Committee, if it's not a complete phase-out, then there needs to be an indexing of the threshold. So that if whatever threshold we do choose, we don't go backwards starting tomorrow simply because of inflation. So I guess, I hear Representative Boquist's counsel on how to move forward with this. We'd certainly be happy to work with you on designing whatever it might be. Our dream, of course, would be to take 3523 and amend it to include all the things in 3479. Because I think there's 3479 has a lot of valid attributes about it, things that aren't included in 3523. And I think those should be included. All three natural resource industries are in need of this. So whatever you do, do that quickly. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hope you're going to be okay, Don. Jeff Stone, Director of Government Relations for the Oregon Association of Nurseries. I'm pleased to be testifying before you today. Preserving family-owned nurseries is a priority for the Nursery Association. At the state and federal level, discussions on the state tax focus primarily attention on the effects on family businesses, including farms. As policymakers, you must balance the revenue needs of the state with the tax that unfairly burdens family businesses. The burden is mainly due, as Representative Clem pointed out in his testimony, that the estate tax value is held in illiquid assets, such as land, buildings, and equipment. It's our view that the estate tax forces these businesses to liquidate vital assets in order to pay the tax. What state and federal legislators often face is an effort to outright repeal. My good friend from the Farm Bureau expressed that today. The OAN thinks that that may be the home run ball that Senator Johnson mentioned. We're not advocating today outright repeal, but we are advocating for supporting common sense tax policies that keep farms within the family. Over 600 of the OAN's 1,500 members are classified as small agricultural growers. In sales, that means these members have less than $250,000 of sales per year. And as Brian will tell you, $250,000 in order to get there isn't a whole lot. Conversely, I want to try to round out the picture that we have about 40 growers that are in excess of $5 million in sales a year. But that just only demonstrates how the strength of the nursery industry, that we have large and small growers with a variety of different crops that we grow. Refinement of the estate tax is a top priority, as I mentioned, to the nursery industry. We advocate a reasoned tax structure that supports family agricultural operations in the state. The OAN feels that both 3479 and 3523 accomplish these goals in large measure and would urge your support. Let me say a couple kind things about both of these bills. A lot of times we come up and oppose bills. I want to say things positively. 3479, as has already been described, we give about $7.5 million in exceptions. And it gives direct benefit to people who are spouses, children, grandchildren, brothers or sisters. So it does keep it within the family farm. We support Representative Clem's approach of having it be part of five of the next 8 years. The good part here is I would like to laud Representative Boone and Krieger for bringing in agriculture from the very beginning to talk about what is best for agriculture. And we can't say how much that means to us. You know, this particular bill would solve a majority of the problems for our members. House Bill 3523 gives us a real clear understanding that Representative Clem has demonstrated here about the crux of the problem, that it is equipment, land, and things of that nature that can burst you up past the $1 million, $2 million level in a rather quick fashion. For these reasons, we support these two bills and would urge you to look at how this would help the family farm, because we not only think it helps Oregon, but agriculture around the state. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Any questions for this group? Representative Clem.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just wanted to, in case you haven't seen the Dash 1 and Dash 2s, Dash 1 gets property in, I believe. It's got to insert real property, and I think that's what Representative Krieger was talking about. And it also gets the indexing in, the sections on the CPI. And then Dash 2 gets the 5 of the next 8. So separate from the question of 7.5 versus 10 versus none, I think we almost have our vehicle sort of combined already once you take the two amendments into consideration.
Mr. Chair, if I might ask a question. There was a comment regarding removing the 5,000 acre on ag land. Was that, did I understand that correctly, and would support that? For instance, over in Eastern Oregon, I mean, you got a rangeland, you got 10,000 acres, 30,000 acres.
Dash one.
And that doesn't mean that they're excessively rich. At 50 cents an acre, you can buy a lot of land. But I think that would be a wise decision to remove that.
And the dash ones do that as well.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. Sorry we didn't get these to you sooner.
Okay. Any other questions? Representative McPherson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Gentlemen, I grew up on a family farm, and so I have a very warm place in my heart for family-owned agriculture. But when I look at my district, which is isn't part of the urban area, and I look at the small businesses that are in it, many of which are capital-intensive businesses and that have liquidity issues as well, I guess I'm struggling a bit to understand why we would do something for agriculture or forestry that is a tax break as compared to other illiquid small family-owned businesses. What's the difference that we should be taking into account?
Oh, Mr. Chairman, if I might, you have two excellent lobbyists here for the ag community, and I don't know where the lobbyists are for the small business people. Where's their bill? Being a bit facetious.
I wasn't going to go that far. You
know. it was a remarkable amount of candor, though. I'm impressed.
But I do understand your issue, and I have thought about that as well. You know, I guess it's selfish on our part in the respect that, you know, these are dear to us. I mean, we would not be opposed to the small business being included. I think that's a valid. The issue is going to be money, so, you know, we get what we can.
Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, maybe I can take a different tact. Although I appreciate my good friend from the farm.
You want to do tact? Oh.
I think what we're looking for here is a reasoned, targeted approach to this particular issue. Agriculture in particular is prone to urbanization, pressures for growth to convert that farmland to other uses. What we're saying is that the agricultural sector is a viable part of this economy. $4 billion in farm gate, $12 billion in terms of its total impact on the Oregon state economy. So what I think one part that we want to try to do through this tax policy is to promote family farms to be passed from one generation to the other. Let me give you one quick aside. I took Congresswoman Darlene Hooley's staff on a tour of three different nurseries in our state. One tree farm, one that sells the most azaleas in the country, the other one a retail sector. And each of them, without my encouragement, said that they fear that their father's going to die because they don't know how they're going to be able to not sell part of the land, that the tax code as currently constructed would cease their ability to farm their land. Now, that's one example. It happened to be the week after Darlene voted against the estate tax, but the fact of the matter is that her office understands the need to pass farms from one generation to another, and that's the purpose for this bill here today.
I'm going to make a statement too, because I signed on to the one, and in part I did that because you know, having been on ag last time on the committee and being on ag this committee this year, we find out that we are unique in a lot of states. We have a unique landscape. Our farming community is unique. Over 90% of our farms are owned by families. They are family farms still. That's not true in a lot of other states. It's changing. I am concerned that change may continue to happen, and it happens a lot of times at the end of an estate when somebody comes in and decides we're going to buy up these and make a bigger and bigger conglomerate. I think that what we have is something we need to preserve, and I think this is a way of saying, from my perspective, saying to Oregonians that we do appreciate the fact that we are still family-owned farms in this state, and because of that, we're going to give you some kind of a break that's different. So from my perspective, that was a little different as well. Representative Clown.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wanted to respond in a much similar fashion. I sort of look at where do I see the emergency situations, and I represent an urban district, so no one who lives in my district is probably going to get a benefit out of this because there is no farm acreage in my district. But sitting on that committee that starts in an hour, I do see that there are people out there who believe that one cause or another, whether it's regulation, foreign competition, inheritance taxes, something is going to cause them to get out of this business and build houses. And so I was looking at triaging. I don't disagree in philosophy that if there's a small printer in Fortland, they got a bunch of print machines and they're working hard, you know, printing off things all day long, and they die, I don't want them selling the print machines either. I just, you know, as a chief co of both of these bills, there are two out of three of these bills, felt that this was where I saw the real emergency in terms of impending disaster in terms of people getting out of natural resource industries and into other kinds of activities, and would like to address it as quickly as possible.
Any other questions?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, and thank you both.
He's sorry you asked.
No, I appreciate that. It's just it's an interesting policy question. I wanted to.
We have two other people signed up, and they are listed on each of the bills, so they can come up. Christina McNitt and Jim Welsh.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Christina McNitt, and I'm appearing before you right now as representing the Oregon Small Woodlands Association. I just want to say thank you, thank you, thank you, Representative Klim, Representative Roblin, thank you for having the hearing. Thank you to the august panel of legislators you had earlier supporting all three of these bills. I don't care particularly how you do it or which vehicle you do it in or what the combination of amendments are, but this is an incredibly important issue, the inheritance tax, to my members who, surprisingly enough, our ownership class represents almost 50% of the privately held timberland in the state of Oregon. And Representatives McPherson and Maurer, I think you brought up good questions about why would we discriminate or set up a tax policy for a natural resource-based industry as opposed to the other small business industries in Oregon that have equally persuasive challenges upon the death of an owner. And my response would be that this is my fourth session representing the Small Woodlands Association. And every session prior to this, I have worked in conjunction with the National Federation of Independent Business, and they're very able and good lobbyists to try to pass some sort of inheritance tax modification that increases the $1 million threshold. And every time that issue has failed. And so I think the answer to your question, to be perfectly blunt, first is a matter of political viability. And the second is, I think that there's an honest response in that the public, Oregonians, value what natural resources bring to the character of our state. And I know they particularly value what forest landowners bring to our state. And what's interesting about non-industrial woodland owners is that we are more likely to have lower elevation forest lands. And so we have a lot of riparian streams and very critical pieces of the landscape to protect for clean water and clean air. And not only that, we provide wildlife corridors in an increasingly urbanized environment. Our members are unfortunately transferring out of ownership to the tune of 22 to 26,000 acres a year. And some of the issues they cite are regulatory uncertainty, the burden of complying with some, like Forest Practices Act, because they may harvest once or twice in a generation and they don't have the professional forester on staff to assist them through that process. Inheritance tax is a huge issue. The fact that they may or may not be able to live on the tree farm, and so it becomes a burden on the weekends. The dad loads the kids in a truck and hauls them out 40 miles to go work on the tree farm, and to them, that's not a lifestyle. That's a chore. And so we have a number of issues, but one of the most important that we hear from our membership is inheritance taxes. And I really believe in the Forest Practices Act, and I believe in what we do as landowners to protect public resource values, and I think that that could be a legitimate case for carving out an inheritance tax bill for natural resource industries. And I'm willing to help any of you in any way craft a bill to move on to the Revenue Committee.
Thank you. We'll get both of them with the questions.
Chair Roblin, committee members, I'm Jim Welsh, representing the Oregon Cattlemen Association and Oregon State Grange. And we agree certainly with the previous testimony and a lot of the testimony today, and I think there's been some very good questions. We believe that, you know, reducing the threshold or reducing the burden on the families and natural resource industry, it would be a very good move, and it's really good for agriculture, for families, economy, and local and state economy, and for those revenues. And we believe that that transfer of that property due to a death is and we have certainly gone through that in our family too, certainly on a piece of property that's outside of the state and everything. So we've experienced some of this, and it is a burden. And if you have to do some things to compensate for this, it can be devastating to the future of and viability of your business and your natural resource business for sure. We would certainly support doing this for all other industries overall, increasing the threshold or reducing or eliminating completely the inheritance tax in the state of Oregon. We believe that would be a very, very good move. But we also feel that these three bills and this issue is a step in the right direction. And any incremental step in this direction, we would be very supportive of. But I need to also include that, you know, in the final days here, you know, there'll be negotiations, and whatever you send over, and then that will hit the Revenue Committee, and the Ways and Means chairs have to consider. Make sure this is a good proposal. Make sure it's plenty. Because if you want, you know, the support, certainly from the cattlemen, Oregon State Grange, it has to be really good. Because we know there's going to be revenue increasing efforts. And so, you know, these all have to balance out in the final days. And those efforts can be helped by something like this, we know. So make it good. Thank you very much.
I guess I'll ask, do you have preferences on the three?
Mr. Chair and committee members, I honestly don't. I think that you're in the better position to know what can move forward. I'm not opposed at all to the amendment that you have to continue that resource use for the next 5 of 8 years. I think that that's probably a smart addition. I really would leave this to your leadership and provide my full support for any combination that you come up with.
Chair Roblin, I think we'd be very supportive of whatever you came up to. And it's, you know, there's good in all three of these bills. But I know that the higher the threshold, the more we'd be supportive, for sure, as you would anticipate.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We're going to close the hearings on House Bill 3479, 3495, and 3523. I guess I would ask this committee, we can send all three of them over. I think that Representative Boquist has a good idea there. We can pick just one. We could go and add the amendments to the one and leave it there, or we could have a small group, very quickly, because I would want to work on this as a work session maybe on Thursday if we could get it, or Tuesday of next week. I personally believe we should do something, so it's figuring out what's the best way to go from here, and I would submit any suggestions you might have.
Mr. Chair, I think 3479 is probably the closest to where we want to be with the two amendments. The only issue, and we don't have fiscals on any of them, but the only issue would be what do fiscals look like at 7.5, at 10, and at nothing? Yeah, no cap. So I would say 3479 was sort of the way that Representative Krieger and Boone and I had talked about. Let's go ahead and amend those to improve them, because otherwise the other ones are also going to have to be amended with, you know, a variety of things. And we have -1 and -2 here today, you know, ready for that.
So are people okay with amending those and just going with that one? And I know that there are people who may have a concern about whether we should do it with a due pass recommendation or no recommendation at all. I mean, I'll leave that up to the group here as well. We'll talk about that discussion.
And Mr. Chair, without a revenue impact, it's pretty hard to make a recommendation in my mind. So I will either be a no unless it's without recommendation.
Okay. I appreciate that too.
Yeah, I think I'm in the same place that Representative Dingfelder is. But it's obviously. Giving a tax break to people who are working hard with our natural resource industries is a very attractive thing to do, but when we have to raise the revenue to pay for all the things that collectively we need in the state, and so to send it over due pass without any kind of a revenue impact, I think is a hard thing to vote for in our situation.
Okay. Representative Boakley.
If you'll indulge me, Mr. Chair, I'd like to take one step back and do Revenue 101 real quick here. And I just came from LRO, so everybody understands. And because I mean, Representative Dingfeld and I were discussing this earlier. But so how the Oregon estate tax works today is that even with the new agreement that was passed earlier this session, is we have a $1 million threshold. It's not a deduction. It's a threshold. And that means is if your estate is valued at $1 million or less, that is the threshold and you are exempt. If your estate is valued at $1,001,000, you are now taxed from zero to $1,001,001. Right? So even in discussions that you're talking about presently right now, if you go to, we'll just say, use a different one, so it's at $5 million. Under the present tax code we have in the state of Oregon, even as this is sitting right here, is up to $5 million, okay, you would be exempt. And if it was $5,001,001, you would now pay a state tax as if you were at zero going to $5,001,001. That's how Oregon's estate tax works. And so even in a case like this, if you go to 7.5, I mean, there's going to be a tremendous amount of work to be done in revenue to look at how this is analyzed. Because remember, you're only going to cover, the way the present statute is written now, those that are $7.5 million and less. So suddenly you put bumper bars on it right off the bat. So if you've got a farm that is in eastern Oregon, that's the, you know, the XY ranch of 25,000 acres, and it's valued at $10 million, this bill isn't going to do anything for them at all. You don't get an exemption on it. So that's why I think the importance of sending something, you know, maybe without a due pass to revenue to let them start analyzing this in the time we have left for the session.
And Mr. Chair, I appreciate the comments of my colleague here. You know, what would have been helpful is even to see a table of how many farms or ranches or properties fall within those different thresholds because, you know, I don't feel comfortable making a policy decision without having that information and doing that analysis. And so certainly I think it's that would be the job in revenue. So I like I said, unless there's without a
okay. So what I'm hearing right now as I look at this is that we would look at 3479, put the two amendments in it, and then send it to revenue with a with no recommendation.
I'm sorry, I need a refresher on what the effect of the two amendments does.
Yes.
Dash one adds in sort of real property, which then is equipment, which wasn't in the original bill. It also adds in, if I remember right, kind of a ancillary processing or I'm trying to think of what the term we use is here.
Can we have a discussion about putting it as a committee? Or should I put it as a committee?
Can I just take this discussion?
I mean, just so I would feel more comfortable, we're getting into the details of the bill. I'm going to open a work session on 3479.
So, thank you, Mr. Chair. Dash one, we include adopted children, not just natural. That was one error. And it also includes the real property, which gets the equipment, puts in a CPI, so it, the $7.5 million threshold can go up with inflation, and I believe it also talks about processing operations, takes that out and inserts any property used in processing or marketing of the product. And that's like we heard testimony that you own the boat, you're a fisher person, you own the boat, and you also have a little fish shack, something associated. When you come back in, you sell it off of that place, and so that would be the marketing, or if you do some processing of your fish before you sell it. So those are also included as sort of real property, not just the boat itself. And then I think we put in the adopted niece or nephew as well in dash ones that wasn't in the original bill. And then dash two says, for all those new people we just added in, someone's got to work the property 5 of the next 8 years. Otherwise, you don't get the additional threshold.
And what's the reason for 5 of 8? Why not say the next 10 years?
Yeah. The federal tax code set this up. And it was that sometimes that first year when someone dies, especially suddenly, you don't know that you get in immediately. So someone moves, they sell the house, they decide they're going to move out and take over the family business, but it takes a year and a half to do it. But then they do it for the following, you know, six or seven. And so they put that in the federal tax code as a way to deal with that, and I just asked the drafter to steal it.
The federal tax code has 5 of 8 and 8 of 10. Those are the two options of the federal tax code. There's two under the tax code.
Mr. Chair, I'll move the -1 amendments to House Bill 3479.
Okay. Representative Smith has moved the -1 amendments to 3479. Is there any discussion? Any opposition?
Oh, really?
Okay. -1s are approved.
Mr. Chair, I'll move the -2 amendments to House Bill 3479.
Representative Smith has moved the -2 amendments to House Bill 3479. Any discussion? Any opposition? Approved.
Mr. Chair, I'll move House Bill 3479 as amended to the subsequent referral to revenue with a no recommendation.
Okay, Representative Smith has moved House Bill 3479 as amended. I think it's to the Committee on Revenue by prior reference. Is that
yes.
What you're supposed
mm-hmm.
to say? I finally learned.
Close.
So.
Okay.
There we go. With no recommendation. Discussion.
Okay, I just wanted to ask a question, a freshman question. So one of the things about having, you know, revenue and ways and means sort of on one track and a policy committee both looking at bills is at some point doesn't the policy committee say, we want to say this is a good idea, if you can say that, if you feel comfortable saying that, and then we trust the other entities to say, now can we afford to do that? And isn't that sort of, you know, the process? And that was my only question about not having a due pass. Does it say that we don't support the policy, or does it say, or if it doesn't say that, and it's better to have a unanimous vote, I'd be more than happy to go that route.
My understanding has always been that we didn't have all the information necessary to make the total decision on this bill. A unanimous decision from a committee going that way, from my perspective, has been better than a split decision going the other direction.
Gotcha.
To that policy committee. Because we wouldn't have sent it to them if we didn't think the policy was worth looking at. So by doing that, we are saying it is, in fact, a policy we'd like you to look at. We don't know what it costs. We have some other issues that need to be discussed. That's your next decision. And that's kind of how I've read it. Is that how other people?
Well, I mean, it's up to you, Mr. Chair, if you want to take a vote or not. I mean, it's pretty clear, you know, that I feel like I'd be a no at this point because of not having enough information.
Yeah.
And I think it's just saying that we're moving this to another committee without a recommendation. I mean, we can move it with a recommendation or without a recommendation or, you know. And so it's at your pleasure of what you want to do.
I understand that, too.
You know, so.
Your Chair, would you like me to withdraw the motion and make it with a new pass?
No, I actually.
Because I did that.
I actually believe this.
Representative vote.
Well, it's not a vote. It's just.
No, I actually do believe this is a better way of sending it, personally.
Great.
Okay.
Great.
I think it'll work better.
All right.
I think
and then we have a big obligation, those of us who think this is a really good one, to be there.
Yeah. Be there with me.
Okay. And that's our next best deal. Okay? So, any further discussion? Seeing none, we'll take a roll call vote, and we'll have our assistants.
Representative Boquist?
Yes.
Representative Quinn?
Do I need a conflict of interest in case I have kids someday?
You might say...
No, but you
can do it later.
Okay.
You can do that right afterwards.
Aye.
Representative Dinkelder?
Well, I'm going to be an aye, but only to move it to... This does not mean that I'm supporting this this policy, but only to move it to revenue for further discussion.
Okay. Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Maurer?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Chair Roblin?
Aye. Representative Clinton, if you want to...
Yeah, I just want to declare a potential conflict of interest in case I at some point have kids who do want to work the farm. They could potentially be the beneficiary of some additional exemption.
I'd like to declare the same potential conflict of interest.
No.
I have kids.
Left by the time I
okay. Then... The bill will be sent with a
without recommendation
to the Committee on Revenue. 3479. So thank you very much.
I do have a quick question.
Yes.
The one bill that was from the Committee on Judiciary, it did not say Interim Committee on Judiciary. Is that a Judiciary Committee bill, or is it misprinted as a...
I think it's misprinted.
Oh.
I thought the supervisor, Pearson, and I was produced, was proposing this as the chair of Judiciary because that's what it says on the bill. I think it was strong. Right, that's what I mean. I'm trying to clarify. At the end of last. No, I think it was. Earlier we say interim committee, it was at the interim. They don't ever say that, though. Yes, they do.
Oh, they do.
That would be a misprint on that because I assume that's where this one came from. Yeah, I'm quite confident that our committee this session has not introduced that bill.
I thought, Representative McPherson, you were supporter of this.
Yeah.
Maybe.
We are going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3364. So, I'll have our administrator give a short description.
Mr. Chair, members, House Bill 3364 adds fees for inspection and certification of reforestation projects by the state forester to costs included in project costs for the purposes of income tax credits for reforestation projects. The bill has a subsequent referral to the Revenue Committee.
And so, with that, I'll invite Christina McNitt, Ray Wilkerson, and Peter Doherty from ODF. Thanks.
Thanks again, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Christina McNitt, representing the Oregon Small Woodlands Association. I happen to have an interest in the next bill, too, for another client, so I'm going to pledge to you that we can get two bills done in 10 minutes
okay.
or less. House Bill 3364...
We're looking at work sessions. Pardon?
Do you have to open up a hearing on the other bill if she's going
to
testify?
Oh, no, she's
not. No, I'm not.
Right
okay.
She's going to do that later.
House Bill 3364 would specifically allow the fees charged by the Oregon Department of Forestry for the Reforestation Tax Credit Program to be considered as an eligible cost for the program. The existing eligible costs include site preparation, tree planting, and other silvicultural treatments necessary to establish a stand of timber. Just to refresh your memory about the Reforestation Tax Credit Program, it's been a longstanding program in the Department of Forestry, and it's a program that provides a tax credit up to 50% of the reforestation costs to reforest underutilized lands. And those are typically in two situations. The first, to fully stock a piece of property that's not otherwise required to be stocked under the Forest Practices Act, so it's usually brambles and underutilized. And the second is to restock a forest destroyed by a natural disaster such as fire. As a result of some timber tax changes, the funding for the Department of Forestry's administrative costs of this program was set to sunset last session in 2005. As a community, forest landowners recognized the importance of this program, and so we stepped forward and agreed to pay a fee for service. This agreement was included as a new fee in the Department of Forestry budget last session in closing negotiations, but for some reason, the eligibility of that fee for the program tax credit itself was not included. Okay. House Bill 3364 would explicitly state that the fee is eligible for the tax credit as agreed by landowners when they stepped forward to continue the program last session by instituting the fee for service.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ray Wilkerson, Oregon Forest Industries Council. I'd just like to say me too in support of this bill. This is actually a great program. There's several hundred thousand acres in western Oregon of prime forest land that's basically unutilized due to the vegetation that's on it, brush patches, and this program is designed to provide an incentive to people to undergo the very costly process of converting those lands to productive forest lands, and it's a terrific program, and it's not limited to small woodland owners. It's any forest landowner can take advantage of it, and as Christine indicated, this piece of the credit was supposed to have been part of the bill that passed last session, and for some reason it didn't happen. This cleans that up, so we're strongly in support of this bill, so thank you.
Chair Robleman and members of the committee, for the record, I am Peter Doherty, the program director for the private forest program at the Oregon Department of Forestry. On behalf of the Oregon Department of Forestry, I'm pleased to testify, particularly since it's the day many of us are thinking about tax credits. the As it's been mentioned before, this program's intended to convert otherwise underproductive forest land into well-stocked forest lands. As it was mentioned, it includes lands that were lost to wildfire that do not have salvageable timber left on it. It's also important to note that the large majority of these lands are held by family forest landowners. We supported the original fee for keeping the program going, and we supported including that fee as part of the tax credit. This bill would allow the inclusion of the fee as cost, and while the change seems relatively small and is small in terms of impacts to state revenue, the change makes the tax credit much more accessible to small woodland owners. In the case of small woodland owners who want to undertake a small reforestation project, the fee can actually exceed the amount of preliminary tax credit they get under the program. So it can have a big impact on the participation in the program. And compared to 2005, when the fee was added, the number of small woodland owners participating in the program dropped by 44%. In summary, the department supports this bill, and I'll be happy to answer any questions.
I guess I would ask, were you involved in the negotiations at the last session? Did you believe this should have been a part of it in the previous one, as was testified?
My understanding, I was not here during the last session, but my understanding from people involved in that is what it was supposed to be included in the past bill.
Any other questions?
Just a quick one, Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
Since we just finished going through your budget in the Ways and Means Committee, I'm just trying to recall if this is included in your budget. I don't recall it in the presentation. So as far as the program, you didn't really talk about this program in your budget presentation. So
it's part of the general private forest program. It's not a separate budget or separate line item. It's administered by our stewardship foresters.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Representative Dingfelder, I'd like to point out that maybe part of the reason it wasn't emphasized in the Department of Forestry's budget is that because last session we stepped forward in a fee-for-service situation, that's an other-funded administrative program inside the private forest program.
So there's no general funds involved? There's no matching?
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, no, there are no general funds involved in this program.
Thank you.
If I could add one thing to that, Mr. Chairman, this program was previously paid for out of the Western Oregon Severance Tax for many, many years. Mm. And when that tax was repealed, the administrative costs were no longer covered. And so the landowners agreed to fill that vacuum by agreeing to a fee for service for this program. But it's never had any general fund money in it.
Thank you.
And it does have a subsequent referral to revenue.
That's for revenue because it's a tax credit.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So any other questions for this group? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you.
So we're closed the public hearing on 3364. I think I want to do a work session. Might as well get this going. Okay. So let's open a work session on 3364.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House Bill 3364 to revenue with a do pass recommendation. Yeah. I'm looking for reaction here, folks.
Yeah, I would like that. Yeah.
I appreciate that, and I will support a do pass recommendation on this bill because the way I evaluate it is that the policy choice has already been made that a certain proportion of reforestation costs is going to be supported by a tax credit.
Mm-hmm.
This is including something that is logically part of those costs.
Right.
And now, there will be a revenue impact, and I think that the Revenue Committee has to take a look at that and decide whether that's okay. But as a policy choice, it seems to me this is consistent with what the law already does, and it's just a question of dollars. Whereas the bill when we were wrestling with before raised some somewhat larger and broader policy choices that made it uncomfortable to me to be moving it on that way.
Yeah, I concur. And Mr. Chair, and also again, the Revenue Committee needs to assess what the revenue impacts are, although it sounds like they're going to be fairly small.
but certainly that's for them to decide.
So take a breath. We're looking for our other two members to see if they're just outside in the hall. If not, we will...
They probably went to the Measure 37 hearings.
No, they've got a half hour. Short. Okay, so...
Yes.
Representative Boquist has moved that 3364 with a due pass recommendation with a subsequent referral to the House Revenue Committee. So that is the motion in front of us. Any further discussion? Seeing none, we'll do a roll call vote.
Representative Clem?
Aye.
Representative Dinkfelder?
Aye.
Representative McGee?
Aye.
Representative Maurer?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Excuse.
Representative Boquist?
Aye.
Chair Roblin?
Aye. Motion passes, and we will send that off to Revenue. And now we will open, we'll close the work session on 3364, and we will open a work session on 3291. And with that, we'll let our administrator give a short explanation. We'll see if Christina can keep it to that 10 minutes.
Mr. Chair, members, House Bill 3291 removes water control districts from the list of districts automatically extinguished or from which territory is automatically withdrawn by annexation of the district's territory by a city. There is no subsequent referral, no revenue impact, and we have not yet received a fiscal impact.
Okay. Christina McNett. And Larry, thank you.
Thank you. Oh, thank you again, Chair Roblin and members of the committee. My name's still Christina McNitt, but this time I'm representing the Oregon Water Resources Congress, a trade association of irrigation districts, and we say other water districts that provide non-potable water delivery primarily to farms and agricultural operations. And with me today is Larry Trocey, the district manager of the San Yam Water Control District, which is one of those other water districts that we represent at OWRC. Water districts in general, water control districts in general, are similar to irrigation districts, and they do provide irrigation district water delivery. But they may also provide other services such as drainage, flood control, surface water control services. Water control districts are also operated under a separate chapter of the ORS, Chapter 553. The San Yam Water Control District services 450 patrons that irrigate 17,000 acres of land within Marion County, which I'll remind you is the top ag-producing county in Oregon. And the district also provides 7,000 to 8,000 acres of irrigation or erosion control. House Bill 3291 in front of you was drafted to remove water control districts from the list of other special districts that are automatically extinguished when the entire service areas of those special districts become incorporated or annexed into a city. I know the big annexation word, but this is a small annexation bill. Typically, when special district territories are annexed or incorporated, the annexing or incorporating entity already provides the services, so there is no reason for two service district providers. In the case of water control districts, however, the canals, ditches, and other associated waterworks are not already provided for by the annexing entity, and the need for the district then continues. In some cases, the services provided, like flood control, are almost taken for granted by urbanizing communities. And this bill would make it clear that services provided by water control districts would continue to be provided, and that the water control district would not automatically be extinguished. And with that, I'd like to hand it over to Mr. Trocey, and then we could both field questions.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Larry Trocey. I am the manager of the San Yam Water Control District, and I think Christina gave you a brief summary of the irrigation district or water control district. We do irrigate about 17,000 acres, and we have 5,000 to 7,000 acres of ground we maintain for erosion control. We do that through revetments along the North San Yam River. We also have a hydropower aspect to our district. We are bordered by the city of Staten on the east, to the north by the cities of Almsville and Turner, and to the northwest by the city of Salem. To the south by the city of Marion. It's not a real big city, but it is growing. And then also the North Saniam River. So you can tell we with those urban areas, we are facing enormous pressure from urbanization. House Bill 3291 addresses potential conflict with existing water right holders within a water control district when a city annexes their land into our boundaries, into their boundaries. Unlike a fire district, which has which a city has similar services, or a domestic municipal water supply entity, a water right delivered by a water control district is pertinent to the land of which the right is located. The district has an agreement or contract with the landowner to deliver that water to the land, whether it be inside or outside of the district, or within the boundaries of a city or other service district. Generally, the point of diversion for water rights is miles away from the legal place of use, and there's a substantial and or intricate delivery system in place that carries the water to that actual place of use. Several sessions ago, irrigation districts came to the legislature and addressed the same issue that was facing them. At that time, the legislature approved irrigation districts' ability to continue to deliver irrigation water to users within the boundaries of districts, within the boundaries of cities. It appears at that time that the water control districts may have been kind of asleep at the switch. In most other cases, water control districts have a similar type of legislation as irrigation districts. So generally, we provide, or water control districts provide, the same services that irrigation districts do. In my testimony, I included a map basically just to give you some idea of our district and some of the issues associated with them. The map that I gave you on the right side of the paper, the city of Staten, the water that we divert for our users in the district actually comes from the North Saniam River, about a half a mile above the city of Staten, and then is diverted out and through the system. The cross-hatching and or the shaded areas on this particular map are the irrigated acres within the district. City of Almsville, City of Turner, and then to the top part of the map is the outskirts of the city of Salem. I had to highlight the areas or the actual boundaries of the map because it didn't really come through very clearly, but in that upper left-hand corner, there's a red circle, and that's an area that we've just had. It's a prime example that we've just had with the city of Salem. They annexed about 35 to 40 acres of ground that have water rights on, and the district is responsible for delivering that water to. We have users both below and above that particular area, so our responsibility is still there, whether the city annexes the ground or not. We still have a contractual agreement and a legal responsibility to deliver those people water. The amount of water that they receive for their irrigation ground is much higher than probably the city would provide to them for, you know, water through their municipal system. Probably be very expensive to do that. So the primary issue is meeting our contractual agreement with the landowner. So that's in essence the importance of trying to accomplish something like this.
Questions?
I have just a quick question.
Yep.
In the northern, this is an example there. In the northern area of your district, that's actually up around the state penitentiary, in the same area of the urban renewal district project being put in by the city of Salem. When these places are annexed by the city or stuff like that, what happens to those water rights if they don't continue agriculture or water usage? Do those water rights
I know in Eastern Side they stay intact, but do you then divert the water to other users, or?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yeah, it happens throughout all kinds of areas. But, you know, the first thing is we always ask the particular landowner if they could return the water to the district, because we do have those. We have a waiting list for people wanting and needing water rights. So that is what has historically happened. The water is just turned back to other users. We have had other examples where the water has gone in stream for a period of time, and then in some rare cases, just for non-use, they do end up losing the water right.
Thank you, sir.
Other questions? Seeing none, thank you very much. So that be no questions on this one? Any questions? No questions. Yeah. So we'll close our public hearing on 3291. And before we go on, I'm going to open a work session back on 3364. Is that the one we passed? Mm-hmm. And if Representative Clem would give me a motion to suspend the rules. So I can vote. I will open a work session on 3364.
Mr. Chair, I move to suspend the rules.
So that
Representative Smith, I didn't know who meant it. Mr. Smith could vote on the bill.
Thank you very much.
That lady over there.
Lady in pink.
Any opposition? Seeing none, Representative Smith, how would you vote?
I would vote aye.
Representative Smith votes aye on 3364. Thank you, committee. And we will close the work session on 3364. And I am of the opinion we should open a work session. So is there any concerns? I'm going to open a work session on 3291.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I'll move House Bill 3291 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Smith moves House Bill 3291 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a bill I co-sponsored with Representative Girard, and it is a kind of a no-brainer. I didn't even have City of Salem angry with me over this particular thing. I have other areas of the statute about automatic extinguishing of certain districts that would be something that are debatable, and I may bring back another session, but this is a good one. It won't cause you heartache.
Mr. Chair, if I reckon there's a volunteer for a carrier, there was one.
I was going to get a consent calendar. So.
You can get a consent calendar.
This does look like a consent calendar.
Probably is. Let me just ask a question to make sure I'm clear on what happens. Are the water control districts supported by property taxes within
assessed fees?
Fees within the area.
Yeah. Okay. Of the member.
Per acre.
Yeah. Got it.
We have a head shaking.
Come on up here.
Yeah,
we have a person that's a good question.
And
please state your name again as for the
record. For the record, Larry Trocey, Santiam Water Control District, Mr. Chair, Representative. We assess our water users on a per acre basis. Okay. Only the users within the district that have hold water rights are assessed. They could be, when the district was set up, they could have been the property that within the total boundaries of the district could have been assessed, but in this particular district it was not. And I believe throughout the state most water control districts are that way.
Per water acre.
So they
by the acre of water acre.
Yes.
So what I think I'm hearing is that there's annexation would have no impact on how you collect the fees to support the work of the water district.
Mr. Chair, correct.
Okay.
Generated another question.
Oh, yeah.
It's like, what happens, can a landowner, so when you know, an area is annexed within the city and it's developed, because that's what's happening, right?
Yeah, the same question I asked.
Okay, so could they elect not to decide they don't want your service and not to pay the fee, and then you're stuck with fewer, within your district, then you have fewer and fewer people that are paying the fee?
Sure.
That's the exact question I asked while you were out.
Yeah.
Okay, sorry.
Representative,
great minds think alike, yeah.
I think I'm understanding you correct. You're saying if somebody wanted to leave the district or if somebody did not want to continue on with their water rights.
Yep. Okay, so it would just be transferred to somebody else, and you'll get that fee through a different ratepayer, basically.
If someone wanted to give up their water rights, then we have a waiting list of people that are interested in water, and they would have the first opportunity, first chance to get it, or that individual could give up their water rights totally or put it in stream. There's lots of options that an individual could do.
Okay, and I apologize that I was talking to my staff. Okay.
Mr. Chair, I don't have a question. In irrigation districts, and I know that this is a little different, but in irrigation districts, that in our particular circumstance, that if you want out of the irrigation district, you don't just stop paying. You have to buy your way out. Or you can continue to be billed for water that you have no access to or really no right to access to in perpetuity. And so this is a very complex issue, at least in our district or in my jurisdiction. And so it's not always very simple.
Okay. Any further questions or discussion? Thank you. Okay, so we have a motion on the floor for a do pass. Any other discussion? Okay. Then we'll have a roll call vote.
Representative Boquist?
Aye.
Representative Klimt?
Aye.
Representative Dingfelder?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Maurer?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Chair Robel?
Aye. Motion passes, and I think this is one that could go to consent calendar? What do you think?
I think it needs more explanation, so I think Representative Klimt should carry
it. Okay, that'd be fine. Yeah.
Well, it was an objection to the consent calendar, wasn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, then we will have Representative Klimt carry his bill.
What's his bill?
So we will close our work session on 3291. And any other issues for the committee? We actually get a break between this one and the next committee meeting. 15 minutes. This is pretty exciting. I thank all of you for your work, and we will close our committee meeting on Ag and Natural Resources. Thank you.